thank you for being a Bump2 subscriber. Your subscription and your support is what makes this podcast possible. In the second part of my conversation with Oliver, we explore a variety of topics. We talk about finding true meaning in our lives. We discuss love as a state of being. And we look at the tremendous power in recognizing and cultivating our innermost and greatest desires. That often brings me to the question of, what is reality?
Wow, that's a big one.
I know. I have no answers. But what is reality? And is it what we choose to construct? Or is it all these social mores that we have?
Well, for me, I would say reality is that presence, that stillness, because it's the only thing I know that's absolutely eternal. And it's always there if someone knows how to access it. And everything else is passing. It's almost like a dream. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that I treat life like a dream. I treat life like real life. But this experience of presence that I carry with me, that's the real deal. I remember once when I was meditating, sometimes, as I'm sure you know, sometimes you have these knowingnesses that just sort of arrive. They're almost like a gift. And sometimes they arrive and they're really deep and they have nothing to do with anything that you've ever known before. And that's kind of what makes them so special. And I remember I was meditating and I realized at a very deep level that everyone is eternal. Every soul is eternal. The soul never dies. And in that respect, no one ever actually dies. Their body dies. We experience them dying experience the sadness and all the things that we experience when people die. But to know in myself that everyone goes on forever was amazing. And I think the reason that I kind of knew that is because the reality of the presence is everyone's reality. It's the truest part of them, that essence of love. And we all have like a different essence within that presence, but that presence is absolutely eternal. I see.
Are you teaching meditation these days?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
What sort of people do you find are attracted to learning to meditate?
Quite a big range of people, interestingly. And more interestingly is why people are attracted. That's the biggest range. You know, some people learn just because they want to sleep better or they want to experience less stress when they're with their kids. But then other people want a spiritual path. They want to experience union or enlightenment or unity with God. You know, call it many different things. I like to call it eternal peace because I think that's kind of easier to get hold of and it's a bit more down to earth. But yeah, all sorts, really. But often people who want to escape from suffering, often people who've had a tough time actually learn because they've kind of reprioritized their lives and they know that being at peace is really important.
Yeah, I think, you know, I look at how we all evolve and I think we have to experience extremes often to evolve. Like if you have, in order to find peace, you have to have absolute calamity in your life somewhere, I think. And that calamity eventually drives you towards the other end of the spectrum. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there are some people who just have a pretty easy life and decide they want peace. But most of the people I know, they've gone into the depths in some way or another. And it's changed them. It's made them more open. It's made them more humble. Very often, people seem to change well before they learn to meditate, actually. A lot of the characteristics that come from meditation have already begun to develop. And I think it's very fortunate. You know, I've had plenty of challenges in my life, as have a lot of people. And although I absolutely hated them when I was going through them, now I'm genuinely grateful for them. Because they've changed me and they've allowed me to reprioritize and they allowed me to prioritize peace, love, being kind to people, having a laugh, you know, make all these things far, far bigger than the other things I was interested in, such as success or impressing other people or somehow covering up my low self-worth by being impressive. You know, those were the things that drove me when I was younger. But then I got bashed by life and put through the meat grinder, and I came out the other side, hopefully wiser, and hopefully with much better priorities.
You were really put through the meat grinder with your bipolar disease. What did you spend, was it about 20 years or so, really trying to get this manageable and under control?
Yeah, I think I got it kind of manageable and under control sort of properly about 6 years ago. So I think probably 24 years, either denying it or trying no medication, different things to make it work. And it was there were long periods in that 24 years where I was well, or at least functioning in a way that I thought was well. But it's been pretty rough.
What turned the corner 6 years ago?
Well, I woke up one day and I'd been trying to do without lithium, which is the medication I now take and have been on for 30 years or so. I was trying to be without lithium over a 4-year period. So I came off it very slowly over about 2.5 years, and it was a nightmare. I had lots of psychoses and depressions and put my family and myself under a lot of strain. But anyway, I ended up going to this lovely hospital in Norway. I was very lucky. They were very kind to me. It's called Dr. Hustvei. And they kind of let me do my thing. And then very quickly, feeling no pressure from them, I decided to go back on lithium. And I went on a lower level and it worked really well. But I still had a lot of physical problems, a lot of side effects, a lot of kind of detox from coming off medication and what I'd been through. So I was in a pretty bad way. And I remember one morning I woke up, and primarily because I had been meditating for such a long time, even though I was in a bad way physically, I was very happy by this stage. The lithium kind of allowed me to be happy. It gave me a base level, which I didn't have when I came off medication. And so I was able to be happy, but I was a complete mess. And I came out of my bedroom about 11 o'clock in the morning in my pajamas, just looking terrible. And my wife was in the sitting room, and I walked in, I started laughing. And she hadn't heard me laughing very much in those last 4 years. And she said, "What are you laughing about?" I said, "Well, I've realized that if nothing changes, if I'm always sick physically, but I'm happy and at peace, then I'm fine. I can live the rest of my life like this because I'm happy." And that was a profound change for me when I realized that. That helped me to really, really accept the illness. And then that led, the acceptance led to lots of cool things happening and allowing me to increase my health, to improve my health quite significantly.
What was involved in acceptance?
Yeah, I mean, I think it went over years. And in a funny way, I don't necessarily think I chose to accept. I think it was kind of forced upon me. I kept trying to do without lithium, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And then when I went back on it, I was kind of able to see that I needed to grow up. I couldn't live this kind of Instagram life where everything was perfect. You know, I realized that, yeah, there are side effects. Yeah, there are things I can't do that most other people can do, but that's okay. And so I think it was just through living my life and going through the challenges, I became more accepting. And I also think that through meditation, I did kind of evolve my consciousness. So I became a person who was more ready to accept, I would say.
That must have had a profound impact on the people around you.
Yeah, I think it was very hard for them. I think, you know, initially when I was ill, it was obviously very hard for my mum because her mum had committed suicide. And so then suddenly it's happening again. And that can't have been fun at all. And also for my wife and for my stepson when I was ill, you know, more recently, that was very hard for them. You know, my wife had to sort of carry me for 4 years, which is not easy. And my stepson didn't get the attention that he deserved and he needed a lot of the time. And so it was tricky. But also, there was a lot of love. You know, those years when I was trying to get a grip with bipolar and I was ill and stuff, there were a lot of good times in it. There's a lot of laughter when I was well, and there was a lot of genuine bonding and learning a lot about ourselves and each other. So it definitely wasn't all bad.
Is there a genetic component to bipolar disease?
Yeah. It often skips a generation. And I read somewhere that with genetic bipolar, lithium is generally the most effective medication for it. So yeah, there's been a lot of research into the genetics behind it, but I'm no expert.
Are there any other drugs on the horizon, or is lithium kind of the standard of care?
What's interesting, I listened to a podcast from Kay Redfield Jamison, who wrote an amazing book called Touched by with Fire, I think it's called, and An Unquiet Mind.
That's it, An Unquiet Mind. It was a great book.
Amazing, amazing book. And she said that a lot of the medications pushed for bipolar are pushed because they make money. But lithium doesn't make much money because you can't patent it, because it's a salt. And so a lot of doctors overlook lithium because some of the big companies just sort of want to push their more profitable drugs. And she said that in general, lithium is by far the most effective for bipolar. And she would actually like more and more people to know that, because we shouldn't have market forces driving our mental health treatment.
I remember reading her book years ago, and at one point she talked about what it was like to be in a manic high. And one of the things that she said that has always stuck with me was, after you've flown around the moons of Jupiter or whatever, how in the world can you come back to Earth? How in the world can you come back to a so-called normal life? And that has always stuck with me, the magic of what must be mania versus the reality of day-to-day life. How do you find the middle way?
That's a really good question. My bipolar, I haven't had very many euphoric manias. Most of my manias have been agitated, so they haven't been very enjoyable. They've been more like psychoses, I guess you would call them. But I think for some people it's tricky with euphoric manias, because they sort of drift into it very, very slowly, or they experience it for a long period of time as a hypermania where they can still function. And so it becomes this wonderful way of living life, where they just sort of live from their feelings, and their feelings are amazing. But the interesting thing about living from feelings is that if we get carried away with it, then we kind of are living in a false reality. And yeah, coming back to this reality, I think I've found a lot of meaning in this reality. I think that's how I've coped with it. Like, I really love the people in my life. I love my wife, I love my parents, I love my stepson, I love my friends. I put a lot of energy into those relationships. I think they're important. I enjoy writing books. I do my best to fill my life with things that mean something to me. And then meaning becomes more important than the feelings of euphoria. And for me, meaning is 100 times more powerful than a feeling, like a good feeling. And good feelings are great, don't get me wrong. But to have this more kind of grounded meaning, I think it's very fulfilling for me, actually. And I don't miss that euphoric state at all.
So many people spend so much of their lives searching for meaning. And you've encapsulated it so beautifully and so simply, really. It's about love.
I think so. I think it's about experiencing love. I think it's being love. I think it's noticing love. Yeah, I think love is a cool way to live. And it's interesting, because it can be a bit airy-fairy, the whole love thing, because people sometimes think of love as this feeling of love that we get when we're first in love, in a relationship, you know, and we have these like 2 or 3 or 4 or 6 months of just like love, and all we can do is think about the other person, and it's great, and it's amazing, and, da, da, da. And then it changes. And it's interesting, because I wouldn't say that experience of hugely emotional love, I wouldn't really say it's love. I would say it's more like obsession. My experience of love is more like a quiet inner love, and then actually living love. So it's being love. So for me, love is a state of being rather than an emotion. It's a big difference. And you can have the emotions of love within that state, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with them at all. They can be really, really enjoyed, but they come and go. Whereas if someone accesses the state of love and learns to cultivate that, then it can be permanent.
I think that's a place that we should all aim to live. And it's really comprised of a lot of baby steps and a lot of interpersonal work, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you're very lucky and you just get born that way.
I guess some people do, but I think most of us struggle along the way.
I think so. And the cool thing about if someone goes through a process to experience that, then you're able to help other people experience it too. Whereas if you're just born in that state, you can inspire people, you can share about it, but I'm not sure it's very easy to teach them because you haven't actually walked that process yourself.
Well, it's like meditation. It's a practice. You have to do it. And it's experiential.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
No, I find it fascinating that I think for all of us, we need to go through these practices, whether it's meditation to still your mind, practice being love in order to receive love and to move in that realm. But it's a matter of effort, and yet it's an effort that's available to every one of us. We just have to choose it.
I think so. I think people have to choose it. I think people have to want it consciously. I think that is important. I think it's interesting within the people I teach and that whole kind of spiritual realm that we're both in, you know, it encompasses millions and millions of people. But there are ideas within that community that I don't think are necessarily particularly helpful, even though they sound really nice. And I think one of them is that, you know, oh, it's just so easy to be love. You just need to decide and do it. Well, I've never seen that happen. I would say that if you want to be love, if you want to be peace or joy, then it would be a really good idea to find some kind of practice that actually takes you to that experience. Not necessarily takes you to some guru who just talks about it all day and tells you nice things about it, but it actually takes you to an experience. So you can leave a weekend rather than thinking, wow, that guy was amazing. How does he do it? Or it's incredible how peaceful he is. But actually leave a weekend saying, wow, I experienced peace this weekend. I'm going into my life and I actually have some kind of idea now of how I can develop that. And the two are incredibly different because one is almost like hearing about chocolate and then telling all your friends about it and writing a book about it and making a movie about chocolate, but you've never actually tasted the chocolate. And the other is hearing about the chocolate and going, I gotta go buy myself some chocolate.
No, I think that's very true. And I think the experiences we have in life are what open the door to this greater realm. They're what mold us, good and bad. But again, if you're on the bad side of the equation, I've really come to believe that you almost have to look for the polar opposite of where you are and just start moving towards it. And that may change a little bit. It may not be exactly where you need to be. But once you get movement involved, things will evolve and things will improve.
I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I think there's tremendous power in recognizing what we want more than anything. You still want other things, but what we want more than anything, what is the one thing we really want? And then, like you said earlier, then taking baby steps towards it. And then it does seem that life starts to support that desire and it starts to take you towards it. And of course, like you say, you might change your direction along the road. But to actually recognize what we want and really start doing something about it is incredibly powerful.
It is, and yet it's not that easy. What do we need to do to start recognizing what we really want and need?
Well, I think there's a very good question we can ask ourselves, which is a big help. And can I tell a quick story about this?
Oh, please, yeah.
Okay, so imagine that you are walking on the beach and it's a beautiful beach and it's a lovely sunny day. It's the perfect temperature and you can feel the sand between your toes and you can sort of feel the wind on your cheek and on your neck. And you're just having a great time and you're by yourself, you know, and just really enjoying your own solitude and enjoying the sounds of the birds and, oh, it's wonderful. And then suddenly in front of you, you look down and you can see something's kind of gold in the sand and you sort of look at it and you're like, wow, that is gold. This is quite exciting. And so you go down and you start to dig around this gold piece of metal and you unearth it and you unearth this lamp, okay? A bit like an Aladdin lamp in the book or the film, depending on how old the listeners are. And you unearth this lamp and it's heavy. It's like a proper, proper gold lamp. It's like, whoa, this is cool. And so you look at it and obviously, just like in the movie, you polish it off And then suddenly, boosh, the whole thing, this kind of explodes, and this blue genie comes out of it. And he's enormous. He's about 3 yards high. And he's got this moustache, and he's got this big booming voice. And he's got a very, very English voice. And you fall over backwards into the sand, and the first thing you think is, what did they put in my coffee this morning? And so you're lying in the sand, and the genie says, don't be afraid. You freed me from the lamp. And you're like, oh my goodness me. He says, anyway, thanks so much. It was awfully cramped in there. I want to reward you. I want to give you one wish. And you start thinking, and you can see you're thinking, and he goes, and you can't wish for more wishes. That happened once, it went very badly. And you're like, oh, okay. And he goes, take some time and tell me what you want more than anything. Not for your family, not for your friends, but for you. What do you want? What is your highest desire? That's the end of the story.
Wow.
And so if any of your listeners, there's probably a lot, you've got a lot of listeners. I think this is the biggest podcast I've ever been on. But that's the way, that's the simple way, is for your listeners, and I've done it too, and I do it from time to time, just to go away and just think about that story and think about what it would be. What do I really, really want more than anything? And then when you know what it is, kind of acknowledge it in yourself so it's strong. If you want to, tell your partner or tell your friends, you know, we're all different personalities, so do what feels good. And you can even write it somewhere. This is what I want. This is my highest desire. And then you just stay alert to any opportunities to move towards it. And when you get an opportunity, move towards it. That's what I would suggest.
Serendipity is very real, don't you think?
Yeah.
I look at particularly traveling. I have the most unusual things come up. They're wonderful. And I don't know how that happens, but it does. And travel seems to be my way of setting the stage for that. But the reality is there's an enormous amount of serendipity in our everyday lives if we just pay attention.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting what you say about travel, because I have a theory on that. I believe that the secret to true happiness, or this presence that I've talked about and you've talked about, is alertness. It's inner alertness. That isn't concentration. It's not like a hard thing. It's more like being a hawk sitting on a post, just looking at the ground, waiting for movement in the bushes and in the grass. And I believe that this alertness, what it does is that as we cultivate it, it tends to quiet our minds more. The mind gets more relaxed, more quiet. So the thoughts don't affect us so much. And when we're traveling, we're so excited by everything. You know, you turn on the tap in a foreign country and it's an exciting event. You know, it's like being a kid again. And I think this is why so many people experience such serendipity when they're traveling, because they're in this state of alertness and presence. They may not necessarily realize it, or they may, but it's certainly one of the reasons why I think people love traveling, because of the inner state they get from it.
I totally agree. It gives you, you're in a state of much greater presence than you are in your normal life, because everything's different. And yet you are the same. So travel provides the perfect mirror and the perfect foil for actually looking at yourself, if you can do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
If you could rewrite your story, would you?
Yes, I would. I know the really like spiritual answer would be no, I accepted everything. It was all perfect. But no, I would definitely reduce the periods of suffering. Now, I mean, seriously, would I? I think because fingers crossed it's kind of over, that extremity of suffering. I mean, you never know, but fingers crossed it's over. Then where I'm at now, I'm kind of happy with it. I'm really happy with how much I enjoy life and how much I'm able to love people and receive love. So in that respect, it's been worth it. If I could definitely shave a few years off the suffering, I definitely would. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I'm not gonna think about those regrets, because it's just not worth it.
Thank you for joining us today. I hope you found something in today's podcast that inspires you along your own life's path, because sometimes a bump in the road is actually a portal into a more conscious and meaningful life. You can subscribe to our free podcast at www.bumpintheroad.us or become a premium member to hear the full conversation. Just go to www.bumpintheroad.us for more information and to sign up.